The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of its hosts, guests, or callers, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of WTBR-FM, its management, other producers, or sponsors.
Welcome to Beyond, an hour-long program of science fiction, fantasy, and adventure. If you enjoy the program, please drop a line to beyond3x5@gmail.com.
Time Curves by Kate Rauner. The heavy metal door swung open on creaking hinges, and Michael took a step away from his lab bench, careful not to jostle any equipment, before turning toward the interloper. His wife, Abby, stopped at the lab door. She always complained about his unshielded experiments and stood far away. Michael? Still hard at it? He started a deep breath, but it burned in his chest, and he suppressed a cough that would only lead Abby to fuss. I thought you were going to a movie tonight. I did. It's over. Are you ready to come home? He tugged at his worn white coat in irritation. I can't. I taught late classes and only started a little while ago. I'm almost ready to run the first test. On your closed time curve? So you can violate the Heisenberg uncertainty principle? She slumped against the doorframe. But your own thesis showed that's impossible. My thesis presented a Deutschian closed-time curve. To satisfy the PhD committee, I was forced to assume a particle would emerge in a universe different from the one where it began. Here, he swept a hand to the bench. But a particle can skip into the future and return to its own universe. Finally, I have the freedom to study what I want when I'm not interrupted. Abby ignored his hint to leave. What about tomorrow? It's our anniversary. You promised. Michael's jaw clenched. There'd be plenty of time for movies and dinners once he'd proved his hypothesis. Still, Abby knew more about his goals than the ossified old farts that ran the department. Conventional theories allowed traveling backwards along a time curve, so no one objected to studying that paradigm. But his inspiration would allow travel forwards. His speculative model troubled the review committee, though they hadn't tried to shut him down. They couldn't afford to ignore the possibility. If he was right, it would be the greatest discovery in physics in a century. His name would rival Einstein, Bohr, and Schrödinger. So the university assigned Michael a lab, even as they loaded him with a junior professor's heavy teaching schedule. But the muttering against him continued. He had to produce some promising results, and soon. What was Abby saying? Something about their anniversary? Yeah, sure. He hoped she'd be placated and leave, so he plastered his best charming smile on his face. We'll have dinner at that little Mexican place you like. Señor T's? It closed 6 months ago. The metal door slammed as Abby left. Not an ideal end to the conversation, but at least she was gone. Michael knew his concept was correct. It was the equipment that remained marginal, hard to calibrate and hard to control. He dragged his old laptop across the bench, tapped a button, and the racks at the end of the lab hummed to life. As the equipment warmed, he pulled a metallic saucer close and plugged in two short cables. Maybe he had been working too hard. His eyes felt hot and swollen, and he rubbed them with the heel of one hand and dropped his other to lean on the bench. His vision was blurry when he tapped the keyboard. A blue flash blinded him. Pain lanced through his hand. Michael shrieked and fell backwards as blood sprayed across the bench. The door burst open and two wide-eyed men tumbled through, lanky foreign exchange students tripping over their own feet. Dr. Fisher, what the hell? Michael knelt on the floor, cradling his arm. Someone pushed a towel against the gushing wound. More people arrived and voices surrounded him. What set off the alarms? Damn it, where are his fingers? We should take them with us. I don't see them. We can't wait. He's bleeding. Through a woozy fog, his hand throbbed on the ride to the hospital. Darsh added plexiglass shields around the equipment, moved the laptop across the aisle to a counter under the window, and secured long cables along the floor with heavy layers of duct tape. He was patient. competent, and exactly the sort of postdoc assistant the department safety officer insisted Michael take on. He had no choice if he wanted to continue his work. Michael had searched the lab thoroughly and found no trace of his missing fingers. They must have skipped on a time curve, but his thrill faded to frustration. The computer hadn't been recording, and he couldn't reproduce the effect. What he needed was a reflector coated with osmium, even a single atom thick, to improve control. Darsh was clearing notepads off the experimental bench when a blue flash. Michael leaped backward. "Darsh, you idiot, who told you to hit the key?" "I didn't touch it, sir." Clearly he hadn't. The laptop lay on the counter behind him, but Darsh wasn't looking at the computer. Blood trickled across papers on the bench where something beige had appeared. Two fingers sliced off below the first knuckle. Michael crept up on the fingers as if they were alive. Maybe they still were. Blood oozed out. "It worked. My fingers came forward in time. It worked." Michael roared in triumph. For the second time in a month, Abby raced to the hospital, urging AutoCab to drive faster as she read and reread Michael's message. "Meet me at ER. Don't fuss. Good emergency." She was interrogating the admissions clerk when he called to her from across the room. She ran to him. "Michael, thank God. I've seen the doctor already." He held up his damaged hand. "The stumps are too far healed for them to reattach my fingers, but the fingers are fresh. Look." He held up a plastic bag and Abby's knees gave out. Michael was helping her to a chair when someone called his name. A tech in blue scrubs braced the inner door open with one foot as he read from a clipboard. "Dr. Fisher, this way, please. We can run your imaging now." That brought Abby fully awake. "What imaging?" Michael shrugged. "Just following up on an anomaly from my last visit." Heat rose through Abby's cheeks. He hadn't told her about any problem. There had been a time when they shared everything, good and bad. It wasn't long before he returned. "The doctor will have the results soon, so we can talk to him in a minute. Hospital waiting rooms must be the last place on earth with paper magazines." He picked one up idly, avoiding her eyes. Once the doctor said cancer, Abby didn't remember most of his words. There was advanced and inoperable, and something about trials. The word terminal was in there, too. Michael was eerily calm and asked all the questions Abby's mind couldn't form. "I'm not going to waste the time I have left," he said on the ride home. Abby nestled against him, still numb. This couldn't be true. They were sitting at the apartment's breakfast bar when Michael's phone beeped a text. His mouth crooked up in a smile as he read. "Who is it?" Abby asked. "Darsh." He talked to the Japanese. "They can deposit a one-atom thick layer of osmium on a steel substrate." His eyes glowed as he held up the phone, wagging it back and forth. "With this, I still have a chance." His face hardened with fierce determination. "Hun, you should be resting." She stroked his arm. "Have you called the people running the medical trial yet?" Michael jerked away. "Their statistics are terrible. I'm not going to waste time grasping at straws when I can accomplish real work." Abby reached for him, but he was already entering a reply, tapping with the fingers on his good hand. Abby came to the lab as quickly as she could. Michael's message woke her long before dawn, but she came. He was working at his usual bench, but balanced on a stool now, too tired to stand. His clothes hung loosely on his withering frame. Darsh looked up as Abby entered. "Sorry to wake you at this hour. May I get you something? The coffee's actually fresh. It's our third pot." Abby hadn't noticed the assistant's shy smile or his kind dark eyes before. Michael never worried about her comfort in the lab. "I've done it." Michael looked up wearily. "I can send something into the future. Anything that will fit in the paraboloid." He pointed a truncated finger at a large bowl, shimmering silvery blue, and mounted sideways on a pedestal as if it were a chair. A potted geranium sat in its center. "I sent this flower 2 weeks ago, and it came through tonight. The petals are still fresh, the soil's still damp. I can control the effect." Triumph wiped the exhaustion from his face for a moment. "I wanted you to see." "I'll arrange for an independent review of the calculations in the morning," Darsh said. Let me download a copy. They're on my tablet. It's under the window somewhere. He waved Darsh away to a pile of papers in the corner. Michael slipped his tablet from his lab coat's wide pocket and handed it to Abby. The password is Abby, he whispered. But isn't Darsh looking for this? Hush. Promise me you'll do exactly as I say. He waved to a nearby stool. You'll sit there. My instructions are in the files. Beneath hollow eyes, Michael's attempt at a charming smile was ghastly. He dragged a wireless keyboard to the edge of the bench and sat in the paraboloid. I'm going to see my work published, see my name become famous. He kicked off his shoes and lifted his feet into the dish, hugging his shins tight with one arm. Behold my magic wand! Michael reached to the bench and picked up three or four pencils taped together end to end. I'm counting on you, Abby. He poked the keyboard. A blue flash filled the room. Darsh shouted, No, no! An afterimage of orange blobs crawled in front of Abby's eyes, and when her vision cleared, Michael was gone. Darsh activated a monitor under the windows. Lines spanned the display with regularly spaced spikes. He skipped ahead. Abby gawked at the display, gulping helplessly as Darsh brushed the screen with a thumb and finger. The graph zoomed out until a dozen spikes showed. The words, tachyon energy, ran up the y-axis and time along the x. She finally found words. When will Michael be back? The assistant frowned at the screen. I can't tell from this file. He used high power. We never tried that before. Abby remembered the tablet clutched in her hand. I have his notes. They stayed in the lab the rest of the night. Abby tried to amuse herself on her phone while Darsh hunkered over the computers. Dawn brightened the windows and the hall outside began to echo with chatter. I must go to the chairman's office and explain what happened, Darsh said. You should go home and get some sleep. What about Michael? Darsh adjusted the graph scale on the monitor and pointed to the black line across the bottom. This is the interval between tachyon events and points where Dr. Fisher's time curve will intersect our own. 130 days, and maybe a few hours. I'll need help to understand his calculations before I can be sure. 100 days? He'll starve. Our time curves have different shapes. Darsh tapped the screen and a second chart appeared with a red line along the top that plunged in a downward spike. This is how Dr. Fisher is experiencing the effect. Here, when we see an instantaneous flash, 2 hours pass for him. And while we wait 130 days, it's an instant for him. Darsh resized the chart. The red line went on forever, diving to the x-axis at regular intervals. Abby's fingertips prickled, and she staggered. Darsh took her elbow to steady her. This can't be happening, she said. 130 days later, shortly before midnight, Abby pushed open the lab door. She carried a picture of her new cat. She'd always wanted a cat, but Michael hated them. Well, she wasn't going to live alone. He'd have to get used to Muffin. You sit here. Darsh guided her to a chair facing the paraboloid dish and handed her a copy of Quantum Physics Today. On the cover, the authors of the featured paper were named in prominent type, Dr. Michael Fisher and Dr. Darsh Patil. Something's different, Abby said. The paraboloid rested on a box instead of its old pedestal. You're very observant. Dr. Fisher is skipping through time like a stone across a pond. I can't influence his vector. But by placing the dish on this unit, I should be able to get a mass reading. He frowned. I hope the manifestation lasts long enough to measure. Flutters filled Abby's stomach. Won't Michael simply step out of the paraboloid? Be back with us, like his fingertips on the potted geranium? Not until energy injected into the system dissipates. Darsh shrugged his forehead. Dr. Fisher and this lab exist in two separate time curves, spiraling each other. Overlapping at an angle. Think of it that way. One intersection won't collapse them into a single reality. Abby plopped into her chair with Muffin's picture in Quantum Physics Today facing the paraboloid. So that's why you asked me to bring a picture showing news from home. But why would Michael appear in the lab at all? We must be 1,000,000 miles from where he disappeared. Earth's orbiting the sun and the entire solar system moves through the galaxy. The phenomenon stays within a specified frame of reference. Darsha's frown deepened. I think it's a gravitational effect. The math department is going through Dr. Fisher's calculations, but there's an unbalanced infinity somewhere. He dragged a couple flip charts into place beside her, clipping open copies of the physical journal to them. A computer began beeping. Let's see how well Dr. Fisher predicted the intersection. Darsh hurried to stand behind Abby and raised his hand to wave. Flash. Intense blue light, and then orange spots danced across Abby's vision. Is that it? She asked. Darsh hurried to the computer. Within 25 nanoseconds. And look at the mass reading. Michael was really there? He beamed at her. Something was there. Isn't it wonderful? No, it's not. Abby jumped up and banged into the flip chart. You were supposed to keep him safe. She kicked the chart over. Fists clenched, she looked down at the scattered pages. How could he do this to me? Why couldn't he just die like a normal human being? Abby sat thoughtfully the next time, seated before more journals propped open on flip charts, while waiting for the flash. Darsh sat next to her, and two postdocs hovered over equipment on the bench below the dark windows. The university had assigned more researchers to Michael's discovery. How's Muffin? Darsh asked. How sweet of you to remember. He's doing well. Runs my life. I've always liked cats. What I said last time, she hung her head. I wasn't fair at all. None of this is your fault. He blushed. I never blamed you. Darsh, do you think Michael's still alive? We can't be sure. We meant the gaggle of assistants. Darsh was principal investigator now, and in a flurry of excitement, the university gave him all the support he requested. We've sent chronometers ahead in one-week skips. That was successful. Most of the rats survived, too. Most? Abby was afraid to ask. Can you bring Michael back? I'm sorry, Abby. Darsh shook his head. It's not even theoretically possible. The postdocs hunched nervously over their screens. Darsh straightened in his seat. Almost time. Abby knocked journals off the flip chart and grabbed a nearby pen. Everything you wanted is here, she scribbled. Come back. Tell us how to get you back. For the first manifestation in the new year, Abby arrived with a turkey sandwich, two brownies, and a bottle of water. Where is everyone? She asked. The energy level of each event seems to be dropping, Darsh said. We need more precise equipment, which requires more space and more electrical circuits. The controls are installed in the next room, and the staff is monitoring from there. He pointed to a row of cameras mounted on the wall. Abby smiled weakly and waved. You look tired, Darsh said. Are you okay? I haven't been sleeping well. Abby pulled an instrument cart over to the paraboloid. We don't know if Michael can interact with our reality, Darsh said as she laid out the food. In the tablet, he wrote that he'd be able to see me, and you think he can read these? She waved at journals displayed on the flip charts behind her. Which means you think our photons strike his eyes. That's an interaction. Not exactly in the way I mean. Flash. After image. The food sat untouched on the cart. Maybe it was too far away, Abby said. She picked up the brownies with a sigh. She handed one to Darsh. No reason to waste these. I made them myself. His smile warmed her, pushing away some of the gloom. The next time, Abby placed a water bottle in the paraboloid and a sandwich and brownies, laid close against the side so Michael wouldn't sit on them, if that made sense. She added paper and a pen. Darsh peered over her shoulder. What's that? She unfolded the sheet reluctantly and showed him. Please tell me if you're okay, was written on it. I suppose I'm being silly. Not at all, Darsh said. You're a caring person. He pulled a pen from his pocket and added an equation below Abby's message, with question marks below a few terms. The last manifestation was more than 10 minutes late. He returned the items to the paraboloid. We could use his help with these calculations. Abby always stared straight to where Michael would be, so the flash left orange after images crawling after her vision. Her tears weren't only due to the bright light. The sandwich, brownies, and water had disappeared. But there was nothing added to the paper. Darsh had been looking forward to Abby's visit for days and called out a greeting when she opened the lab door. I read that you're head of the physics lab now, she said. Congratulations. He flushed, flattered. While never a cutting-edge physicist, it turned out he was a superb administrator. Abby sat in her chair. I read an article about a Paley high school class sending time capsules into the future. The kids seemed hyped about it. The university was pleased with the attention that article received, Darsh said. Most media lost interest when they realized we'll never acquire anything that originates on another time curve. But with this new design, we expect someday to reliably retrieve what we sent forward. But not Michael. I'm sorry, that was thoughtless of me. His chest tightened. He'd been hoping Abby would stay to talk, and if he upset her, she might hurry away. Sandwiches. Flash. After image. Empty paraboloid. Darsh led Abby to the window bench and reached a hand into the 3D diagram hovering there. Michael's drift is accelerating. This manifestation was 32% weaker and 2 hours later than the last one. The margin of error in our calculations is growing, too. Still can't do the math? She asked. Darsh dropped his gaze apologetically. Abby gave his arm a comforting squeeze. Hey, look, tonight's sort of an anniversary. Our 10th manifestation. Do you like breakfast burritos? I found a new Mexican place a block off campus. Abby and Darsh sat quietly together until well beyond the margin of error, but no blue light flashed. Where is he now? Abby asked as she shoved the sandwiches back into his sack. I don't know. We still haven't gotten the math worked out, but Darsh turned to look her squarely in the face. The time curves have diverged. You don't have to come back again. So he's gone. Abby wiped away a lone tear. It's been so long. I didn't think I'd feel anything. I'll miss your visits, Darsh said sadly. Don't worry. You won't have to miss me. She bent close and kissed him. The Psycorps by E.J. Randolph. You won't pass the test. My brother Toronado shot me an evil grin from his side of the well-worn, scratched kitchen tabletop. I squinted at him. Yes, I will. I dug my spoon into my oatmeal and slurped milk and cereal. Gross, Toronado scrunched his face at me. You have no manners. I jumped up and grabbed my jacket. The examiners won't care how I eat, only if I can use the psi box. You know I can. He snorted. Once they see you in action and realize you don't need the psi box, they'll bounce you so hard you won't have an ass anymore. Little brothers could be such a pain to big sisters. I'd learned long ago to ignore most of what he said. Mother turned from the counter where she was chopping vegetables. Toronado, watch your mouth. Tavella will do fine. Toronado glared at me. I stuck my tongue out at him. Sure, the gesture was juvenile, but so was he. You're just jealous. I dashed out of the door before he could respond, my ponytail swinging across my back. I was going to max this exam. I threw my leg over my rusty old robo-bike, tapped in Central Island Spaceport, and roared off. Who'd want to ride in a motorized conveyance when they could feel the wind blowing in their face and hair? I preferred this freedom. I stopped at the entrance. The spaceport stretched as far as my eyes could see. It was the biggest on the planet, Harmony, with endless rows of hangars. Every one held a spaceship that could fly to the stars. My fingertips tingled. I imagined myself roaring toward space in a sleek spaceship, and my heart beat a little faster. This psi box could be my ticket out of dreary career in maintenance or data entry into an exciting life traveling to the stars. A big guard stepped out of a kiosk and headed toward me. I handed him my pass for the exam. His eyes narrowed. You don't look old enough. Jeez. I pulled up my credentials from my wrist computer. I was 18 and counting. His eyes flicked to my face. Yeah, my computer was an old model, but it worked. I raised my chin. I had my pride. What else could I afford? Dad was long gone, and Mom didn't make much processing insurance claims from home. He pointed to the left. Down that way. You can't miss it. There's a long line already. Just my luck. The guard went back into his little kiosk. I tapped the controls, swung to the left, and puttered past several administrative buildings. The line came into view, and I drew in a breath. At least 100 young men and women stood in a line outside a modest white-painted sinkrink building. A side lot held various conveyances. I slid my robo-bike next to a shiny new hovercraft. Whoever drove that would later probably check for rust marks on the side. My robo-bike might be old, but it worked well. I took it apart and oiled everything at least every 6 months. Fortunately, the electronics were simple. If they didn't work, I got a new motherboard. Electronics was not my thing. No, I had a different talent, one that was worthless before the formation of the Psi-Corps, and maybe even now. Certainly one that was worthless until hostile psychic aliens surrounded the planet Lotusandra a year ago and demanded the government provide humans for experiments. The local mediators in physics convinced the aliens to leave. But everyone knew those mindsuckers would be back, and the next time the dangerous beings wouldn't leave so easily. It was up to the newly formed Psi-Corps to block them and protect humanity. Old Earth's research and development teams had come up with the Psi-Box. This invention could detect psychic transmissions and set up blocking frequencies. Everyone heralded the contraption as the biggest leap forward in the Psi-War technology in years. I snorted. If that's all it could do, what was the point? But the authorities thought it would neutralize the aliens' power. Ha! All the aliens had to do was use one of their disintegrator beams. I'd read about how they'd turned it on a communication satellite the last time they threatened humanity, and the satellite had disappeared. But no matter how ineffectual, this Psi-Corps was my big chance. I was one of the few who'd passed the initial screening sent to all the schools. I appraised my competition waiting to take a test. Men and women, mostly from a variety of Navy ranks, stood with confidence, dressed in their neatly pressed uniforms. I grimaced. My clothes were faded, but clean. Mom had figured out how to get a dew-wrinkler working one more time and thrown in my jeans, T-shirt, and denim jacket. My friend Marlene's husband was in the Navy and had brought home an instruction holo for the Psi-Box, so I knew how the device worked. She'd called me to check it out, and I'd watched it over and over until I was sure I could read the correct detection patterns and press the appropriate counteraction buttons. Since I was a whiz at video games, surely I'd be faster than almost anyone else. But in principle, the Psi-Box was not hard to operate. Every last one of these hopefuls would be able to do it. What chance did I have? Maybe I was fooling myself. The line was moving. I tried to read the faces of the hopefuls as they left the building. They were neutral. I guess no one knew whether they passed. I didn't need to open my mind and let their thoughts enter me. My turn came. I walked into the building. It took a moment for my eyes to adjust to the dim interior. A man and a woman sat on the other side of a wooden table. A small black Psi-Box with 12 buttons lay in front of them. Tvela Lasit? The woman's voice held a question beyond that of my name. That's me. I stood with my legs set apart and my head at a cocky angle. Her lips pursed. Do you know how this box works? Her voice dripped with condescension. Yes, I do. Do you have a pass? I handed it to her. She glanced at it. I see, a vocational school. Heat rose up my neck. The man pointed to the black box. Pick it up. His voice was gruff. I held it in the palm of my hand. He pressed some buttons in front of him. I grinned. The first pattern was easy. I pressed the correct counterattack. He entered another set. I responded with a different group of buttons. Patterns erupted across the screen. As soon as one appeared, I zapped it. This was fun. I could do it all day. The screen went blank. The man stared at me for nearly a minute, his face betraying nothing. You may go now. We'll let you know. The woman sat with crossed arms. Nope, she didn't like me. I'd done well, but that might not matter. I was not regular Navy. I came from a vocational school. I dressed in old clothes. What else did they need to know? I was not their kind. I walked out. The lot was nearly empty. I got on my robo-bike, but I didn't go home. I drove past the businesses and apartments that constituted the older part of Felice, the small town that had sprouted up in the last 50 years to cater to the Federation government and Navy personnel based on Central and puttered by the new construction on the rim of the town rising like mushrooms after a rain. I wrinkled my nose at the strong, musky mud-sinkrete odor. On top of a hill overlooking the town, I stopped. A breeze blew past me with the sweet scent of catriol trees. I sat on a flat rock and rubbed my face. If that silly box was all humans had to counter the aliens, we were in serious trouble. How strong were the aliens' inner voices? Could they break through the protective zone I projected every day to keep people's inner voices out? Those examiners didn't know it, but I was the real deal. Maybe the only potential alien hunter who had applied today, and they would probably nix my application. And if they learned about my real talent, that would be worse. Sure, on Lotosandra, psychics were respected, but that's because so many had some talent. No one was uncomfortable. But here on Central, the headquarters of the Federation Navy and government, a psychic made waves. Their best course of action was to help the police or set up a shop. But once outed, they could never expect to be treated like a normal person. Granny had noticed my talent when I was still in my crib. I cried when sad thoughts crossed her mind and smiled with her happy ones no matter her expression. Over the years, she worried about me. Don't let people know. They'll be uncomfortable. They won't want to be your friend. They'll shun you. They won't understand. They'll think you'll do something evil if you can read their minds. I told her usually all I got were emotions. That's enough, she leveled a gaze at me. Believe me. One time on a playground when I was 5 years old, I told another little girl I heard her thoughts in my head. She ran screaming to her mother. Her mother marched over and said she was going to report me, that officers would take me away and put me where I couldn't harm anyone. I said I was lying, and her mother scolded me, but let her daughter continue to play with me. My memories faded with the sunset, and I returned home. Mom looked up from the table. How'd it go? I shrugged. Don't know. They're going to let people know. You'll get in, she smiled at me. Mom, you're always an optimist. I kissed her cheek and slid into a chair. What you fixin'? Cutting some vegetables and potatoes for a stew. I picked up a peeler and applied it to the side of a potato. No food fabricator on our counter. Those contraptions were expensive. On the plus side, Mom was an excellent cook, and we ate better than anyone else on the block. And nothing matched the smell of food cooking on our old stove. We sat down for dinner. Tarando smirked at me. Didn't get the job, did you? Mom laid her fork down. She doesn't know yet. Mom's voice was firm. She wasn't going to allow any teasing. Tarando mumbled something under his breath. The next morning, a Federation messenger knocked on the door. I opened it, and she held out a screen. I placed my thumb in the designated spot. Report at once to the Psi Corps. The message tucked the screen under her arm. I stood stock still. She smiled. Better get a move on. Oh, yes, right away. I popped into the house and bounced on my toes. Mom, I made it. She hugged me. I gotta go right away. I grabbed my jacket and hopped on my robo-bike. This time at the entrance to the spaceport, the guard held up a screen and waved me through. Yep, I'd been entered into the facial recognition database. I was officially in. I parked and entered the building, where only two people sat at a table a day ago. Office partitions divided the space and people hurried around. Did this place have a receptionist? No one noticed me standing. I pasted a smile on my face. Didn't do any good. No one seemed to have time for a new bee like me. A few minutes later, a harried young man came forward. He glanced at a screen in his hand in my face. Ah, Tavella Lottet, come with me. He turned and hurried down a hall. I followed him into a room. At least 20 people sat at desks. A man in a white uniform trimmed with silver stood at the front. He glanced at me. Please sit. He glanced at his wrist computer. In the future, be on time. I sit. I sat in an empty chair near the door. He explained the functions of the Psi box and handed one to each of us. He set up patterns, as in the test. I zapped them faster than anyone in the room. Ha! All those video games taught me something useful after all. The instructor watched me for several minutes. All right, turn your Psi boxes in, he pointed at me. Stay for a minute. The room emptied and the instructor sat on the corner of his desk, his hands on his leg. "I noticed you're the fastest in the room. I need to assign someone from the Psi Corps to a small diplomatic delegation, to a new alien society. We need to know if they're psychic. They give no indication, but this will be a good field test. I'm sure you'll see even a fleeting waveform. Was this my big chance?" Blood pounded in my ears and I nodded. "Be ready tomorrow. The spaceship leaves at noon." My pulse raced and I clasped my hands together. My big break. He glanced from my shoes to my t-shirt. "We have the first of the Psi Corps uniforms." He walked to a locker. "Size? 10. He held out two white with silver trim uniforms. A bolt of lightning zigzagged across the front. I quivered. Uniforms. These made me official. I suppressed a smile. "Thank you, sir," he grunted. "On your way out, pick up your authorization from the front office. That'll be all." In a daze, I walked to the front office. My smile stretched my lips so hard my cheeks hurt. "I understand you have something for me." A man in a regular Navy uniform handed me two info cubes. "Everything is here. The first contains your authorization as a member of the Psi Corps and your orders attaching you to the diplomatic mission to Barnega. The second has a translation program for the Barnegans, along with what little information we have about their planet, mostly orbital scans." I strode outside and packed my uniforms with care into my side pouches. I sped home, breaking the speed limit, and burst into the door. "Mom, I have a mission." She clutched her apron. "Where?" "To Barnega." "Where?" "New alien contact." Her eyes widened and she pressed her hand to her mouth. "Don't worry, these aliens aren't supposed to be psychic. I'm along to make sure, though. The director said he will post us to embassies, legations, and even Navy ships as soon as he thinks we're proficient with the Psybox. We need to be where psychic danger could be encountered." Her brow smoothed. "I better help you get ready. I have two uniforms. I can clean one in the dry shower aboard every spaceship while I wear one. Maybe one pair of jeans and a couple t-shirts. I don't know how formal I'll have to be. All I need is one small bag." The next day, Mom dropped me off at the spaceport entrance an hour before departure. She gave me a final hug. "Write when you can." I walked into the cavernous hangar listed on my schedule. A courier spaceship sat with the gangway down. A woman at the main hatch asked my name and assigned me to my quarters. It didn't take me long to unpack. I sat on the narrow bunk, pulled out a screen, and played a video game. The intercom clicked. "Prepare for departure. Strap into your seats." My room had a sturdy chair with a pull-down harness. I buckled in. Shortly, a low hum heralded ignition. The acceleration was smooth. The intercom came on. "Free to unstrap and move around. Time to explore." I left my quarters and walked down the passageway to a room with tables and chairs. Ah, a dining room. Two men with white hair and deeply lined faces talked to each other. I continued to a lounge with comfortable couches where two women sat. Their salt and pepper hair was coiffed and their diplomatic uniforms pressed. Yikes! Everyone on this ship looked old enough to have grandchildren. One of the women looked up and frowned. "I see our Psi Corps member showed up." Her voice conveyed she considered me a useless encumbrance. The established order never liked big changes. But the Psi Corps was here to stay. I wasn't going to tell them, but they'd have to get used to the new reality. It was going to be one lonely trip. Good thing I'd brought lots of video games and holooks. 2 weeks later, the captain announced our arrival at Barnega. We landed, and he let down the gangway. My first day in an official capacity. My future all to be decided on one day. I trembled. Could I handle this? I had to. I smoothed my uniform, grabbed my Psi box, and followed the four senior diplomats to the tarmac. Fragrant flowers in bright, bold colors rimmed the spaceport. In the distance, the colored spires of a Barnegan city sparkled in the violet hue of their sunlight. A small group of Barnegans, tall, spindly beings with rainbow-hued skin, greeted us. I cupped my Psi box in my palm. A blip. What? These beings were psychic. I pressed the appropriate button. Another. I tensed, then nothing. I glanced around. Maybe only a few here were psychic. A small blip. Fine. I got it. Several more Barnegans walked toward the spaceship. The blips lengthened and increased. I pressed a series of buttons. The Barnegans looked at each other, and the blips changed shape. A wave of dominating emotion spilled over me, pushing me to my knees. My fingers shaking, I pressed several buttons. If anything, the wave intensified, the Cybox completely useless. Their emotions poured into me. Never before had I encountered so much psychic force directed toward me. I was filling up like a balloon. My head bowed. I laid my hands onto the ground, holding myself up. I couldn't contain any more. It was impossible. I would burst. I forced myself to stand up and let out all those feelings toward them as if I were a mirror. The more they threw at me, the more I reflected toward them. They stumbled backward, holding their arms over their heads. My vision turned white. They looked like they were shrinking as if they were balloons with holes. How curious. They didn't seem at all scary now that they were so small. I took several steps forward, the ground seeming to shake with every step. I held up my arms. This will stop right now. They tilted their heads up as if I'd grown to giant proportions. Please, one in the front row screeched, and my wrist computer translated. We're sorry. We won't do it again. Okay. I took several deep breaths, letting the emotion dissipate. They rose to their feet and bowed their heads. We didn't know you had the power. We will give you all the honor you deserve. The Federation diplomatic delegation stood frozen, mouths agape. The words coming from the Barnegans and their actions couldn't have made any sense. I turned to the lead diplomat. I think everything will go smoothly from now on. The first field experience with the Cybox was a success. The locals do have psychic abilities. The box countered their efforts to take over our minds. I'd use my own psychic abilities, but what would the diplomats believe? But would the diplomats believe I'd use the box? My whole future depended on their misperceptions. They had to believe in the efficacy of the Cybox and my proficient use of the device. The head of the Federation mission nodded. We'll recommend the new device in our first report to headquarters. Phew. I smiled at the Cybox in my hand. No doubt about it. I love technology.
Routing a New Superhero by Jeff Mead. Journal Entry 236, Winter's Day, 1347. I think that will do it. The last injection should be the correct formula to introduce plant cells into the human body. Hopefully this will allow me to use the infernal sun's power as a food source to survive in this accursed winter wasteland. Journal Entry 237, Winter's Day, 1353. It's been almost a week, and I've been terribly sick. I can definitely tell that the bioserum I injected in myself is working. It's changing my very genetic structure. I've noticed that my eyes are turning yellow, and my skin has a green bioluminescence. I should, I guess, have thought about that fact, that my skin would be its primary source of dietary consumption if I really am turning into a plant. Does this mean I'll have to walk around naked all the time? Good thing there's no one else around to see my tree stump, LOL. Journal Entry 238, Winter's Day, 1354. First report of sun feeding. I'm totally sunburnt. I spent 3 hours topside yesterday afternoon, walking around in my birthday suit, and I'm burnt from head to ankles. I have a stupid tan line where my boots were, and there's funky tan lines also where my backpack straps were. I've been lonely for so long that I never thought I'd actually be glad no one is around to see how stupid I look. Journal entry 239, Winter's Day, 1364. It's been 10 days since my last report. I'm struggling to eat solid foods. The canned goods I have stockpiled in the bomb shelter are not staying down. I've had violent diarrhea every time I eat, and I'm maniacally thirsty. It's like I'm addicted to water. I think I'll try infusing water with fruit sugars for added nutrients. I feel like I have to start experimenting with plant fertilizer just to feed myself properly. This experiment is just getting weirder and weirder. Journal entry 240, Winter's Day, 1374. Another 10 days. I've been spending significantly more time topside naked. Emerging from the bomb shelter no longer hurts my eyes, but being inside actually does. I think my eyes have adjusted to the serum injection and become sunlight dependent. It's like my very eyeballs are sunglasses now. Journal entry 241, Sunday 1. I've pretty much stopped eating solid foods. My primary source of sustenance is now the blazing sunlight. I don't even burn anymore. I can actually feel my body absorbing the sun's rays, and there's a tingling sensation after about 30 minutes walking around. I think I can actually feel the chlorophyll in my skin cells converting around sunlight into energy. I think this mad scientist plan I had of turning myself into a plant has actually worked. I'm officially changing the name of my calendar system to Sunday, as the nuclear winter is no longer a limitation for me. I'm restarting the number system of how I count the days as well. Journal entry 242, Sunday 10. Another 10 days has gone by. I think I can officially say that I'm no longer reliant on basic human foods. I have the digestive system of a plant now, requiring only sunlight. I've decided to pack up my belongings and start searching for other survivors. The last survivor I ran into was 2 years ago, and they mentioned a settlement near Taos, New Mexico. I think I'll head down that way and see what I can find. I'll need to follow the river, though, to make sure I have water. But that's good desert country, and I'll have plenty of sunlight for food. How neat to say that. Journal entry 243, Sunday 16. It took about a week to finish packing, and I've been walking for a few days. I've walked about 60 miles, and it's a barren wasteland out here. The city of Denver is still a smoldering heap of bombed concrete and ash, and I didn't see or hear any survivors. Perhaps if I find smaller towns away from the major blast centers, I'll have more luck finding survivors. Journal entry 245, Sunday 30. Another 10 days have gone by. I've walked a long way and still haven't seen anyone. Am I the only survivor? I have to believe that's not the case. Journal entry 246, Sunday 36. I found people. I'm just outside Chama, New Mexico. And I found a small village that's established like a trading post. I got some strange looks because it's not every day that A, a wanderer comes in from the wasteland, and B, wastelanders probably don't stroll around wearing only a loincloth. I've even stopped wearing shoes because my feet are bark-like, now, so I don't even need any foot protection. And I'm overall just a green color now, so that scared quite a few people. But these folks who called themselves Shemites were overall hospitable. They don't see me as a threat, although they were rightfully wary at first. I had a great meeting with a group of 5 townspeople, 3 women and 2 men, who gave me a bit of their history. They said they've been in Chama ever since the bombs went off. The bombs tended to hit any sizable population center or anywhere that there were military installations. So Chama was saved, as it's always been a small crossroads between Colorado and New Mexico, and not deemed a military target. I spent enough time with the town council to understand that these are not warlike people, but they've been having trouble with a group of local raiders that are desperately trying to break into the underground quarters where the people are. Most of the surface level of Chama has been pilfered by this group of marauders, and they want my help, as I seem to be the only one who can openly traverse the surface without suffering health consequences. I think I'll help this group, and maybe they'll let me stay on with them. Journal Entry 247, Sunday, 40. I've been out in the waste for over a week, surveying the band of raiders harassing the Chamites. There's about 20 of these scoundrels, but it's hard to tell who's who, because they are covered head to toe in rags and gear to protect from the sun. They've got a cage of Chama captives sitting out in the sun, and they absolutely torment these poor people. The town council told me that I could bring the captives back to the Chama underground if I can figure out how to spring them. Journal Entry 249, Sunday 52. I got a hold of one of the smaller raiders and stashed him in a pile of rocks outside their encampment. He was terrified of my green skin and thought I was an alien. I laughed at that, as Roswell isn't too far away. But I realized that I have the power to make roots and plants grow now. And I used them to wrap this guy up. Pretty awesome superpower. I'm going to go into camp while everyone is sleeping and quietly wrap vines around the doors of their poorly built housing structures. I'll free the captives and come back for my prisoner tomorrow. As soon as the sun goes down and everyone is sleeping, I'll make my move. Journal Entry 250, Sunday 53. Last night was terrifying, but successful. I got rolling late, as most of the raiders stayed up drinking some kind of homemade moonshine. Most of them were drunk as skunks by the time they went to bed, so I didn't have to be as quiet as I had thought. But I was sneaky and silent and terrified beyond anything I've experienced since the day the bombs fell 12 years ago. Heart thumping out of my chest and skin tingling with anxious excitement, I made my move. I crept into camp and tested my powers of growing plants. Reaching out my hands, I concentrated on extending my fingertips. Little shoots sprung out of the ground wherever I directed my focus, literally willing plant life to emerge. These neophyte plants grew up, and I was able to use my mind to twist them all together. Once I had created a thick latticework over the door of the first hut, I focused on hardening these green shoots and turning them into brambles. This made them thick and tough, almost like dead vines. And the beautiful thing is that this only took about a minute of deep concentration. I moved from hut to hut, keeping a careful watch for any guard patrolling the camp. But these raiders didn't feel the need to be cautious, convinced they were the only ones foolhardy enough to survive topside in the wastes. The sun is so strong on the surface that it burns anything in its view. So I quietly crept from one hut to another, closing off doors and windows. In about an hour, I had the whole camp on lockdown. Just before sunrise, I headed towards the cage holding the captives. There were seven of them, and looked almost dead. Skin burnt, hair frizzled and dehydrated, almost beyond salvaging. I quietly dispatched the lone guard, with the captives watching in wide-eyed fascination at this green plant man. They had just enough strength to sneak back to my hideout in the rocks where I had left the last captive. We decided to leave him trussed up, either for dead or for finding by his comrades. It took us nearly 3 days to get back to the Chama underground. I grew a crop of cactus plants, and cutting them open created enough fresh water to rehydrate the captives just enough for the journey to safety. The people of Chama were ecstatic that I had freed their family and friends and regarded me as a superhero. They asked what they could call me. I said, "Call me Chlorophyll."